This is Taking Aim with
Rob Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, September 23rd, 2003. The drums are beginning to beat on Saudi Arabia. Those are the words of Robert Oakley, former U.S. ambassador to Pakistan and currently a consultant to the Pentagon. The drums are beginning to beat on Saudi Arabia. He spoke those words in July of 2002, shortly after the July 10th meeting of the Defense Policy Board, a consulting group to Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. And at that meeting on July 10th, Lawrence Muravich, a RAND Corporation analyst who had been former advisor to the French Ministry of Defense, made a startling comment. In his presentation of 24 briefing slides, he stated, the, quote, "The kernel of evil, the prime mover, the most dangerous opponent in the Middle East is Saudi Arabia." His comments were followed shortly thereafter by two articles in publications of the neoconservatives and Zionists. One, the July 15th issue, 2002, of the Weekly Standard, edited by William Crystal, one of the founders of the Project of the New American Century, and the former chief of staff to Donald Quayle. And the title was The Coming Saudi Showdown, by Simon Anderson, who is a member of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and AIPAC spinoff. Following this, in July 2002, also in the issue of commentary, which is published by the American Jewish Committee, was an article by Victor Davis Hanson, "Our Enemies, the Saudis." Setting up the Saudis, our Taking Aim program today. Ralph?
The theme of the Saudis as the real culprits and the authors of the events of 9/11, the hidden sponsors, both financial and militarily and in terms of actual coordination of the events of 9/11, has been orchestrated now with a great intensity, both in Time magazine and in particular with reference to a book that has just been published to great fanfare called Why America Slept, by Gerald Posner. It's interesting to note that Gerald Posner is the man who had recently published a book called Case Closed, which attempts to establish that all of the evidence pertaining to the role of the CIA and of the U.S. government in the events of the execution of John F. Kennedy were in fact false, and that the official fiction about the lone nut assassin Lee Harvey Oswald and the Warren Report's conclusion that Lee Harvey Oswald, a putative Marxist and Cuban sympathizer and defector to the Soviet Union, was the lone assassin of John F. Kennedy, Case Closed, is the thesis that attempts to resurrect the official fiction. And he does that as well, does Gerald Posner, with regard to the execution of Martin Luther King, particularly in the aftermath of the dramatic trial in Memphis, Tennessee, in which the family of Martin Luther King finally brought to an actual jury the evidence of the military intelligence hit teams in place at the moment of the execution of Martin Luther King, a jury, after deliberating considerably, concluding that indeed it was a government operation, the U.S. military. Posner, on the contrary, with the Martin Luther King book, as in the case of the Kennedy assassination, assigned the task of resurrecting the official fiction and attempting to disavow and debunk the evidence to the contrary. And it's interesting, I think, in regard to why America slept, before we examine it in more detail, that Bill Turner, the noted author, the former Federal Bureau of Information investigator who has published and has researched over 40 years the role of the FBI and the CIA in such events, Bill Turner talked to Gerald Posner, who acknowledged to him that it was Robert Loomis who is the president and chair, the CEO of Random House, who had approached Posner with the proposition that he do a book resurrecting the CIA and exonerating it from any involvement in the Kennedy assassination. In fact, Robert Loomis was on record as having stated that all these efforts to show that the Central Intelligence Agency has anything to do with assassinations anywhere is but trash and deeply offensive to me. Well, Robert Loomis's wife, Gloria Loomis, was the secretary to James Angleton, the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, and, as it happens, a primary figure in the organization of the Kennedy execution. And indeed, he was the editor of Why America Slept, pushed everywhere from Time magazine to the New York Times in setting up the Saudis. And Posner has been appearing in interviews, and indeed on the Pacifica Network itself, where he has been promoted in relation to the disinformation that he is promulgating. He has attempted to suggest that the interrogation of Abu Zubaydah, who had been captured along with Sheikh Khalid Mohammed and tortured elaborately, torture with which, in fact, Posner, with some sang-froid, describes without compunction, torture involving pain injections and then pain relievers alternated simultaneously to create great pain and then relief from pain, drugs that cause dissociation, an entire set in which he was said to have been in Saudi Arabia, and out of this, they represent that Zubaydah said, oh, call the Saudi prince X, Y, and Z, and he gives the telephone numbers, and they will tell you what it's all about and how I was directed by them. On the basis of this unidentified source for the Zubaydah nominal confession, they are concluding that it was the Saudi royal family that was involved in the 9/11 plot. And indeed, the thesis of the book is that the Bush administration is embarrassed by the realities of Saudi responsibility. Setting up the Saudis is indeed the thrust, the theme, the orchestrated disinformation, because the Saudis are indeed being set up for a long-standing plan to dismantle that particular regime and to seize the oil.
Ralph, what isn't stated is that what the Saudis were doing when they were funding al-Qaeda, what they were doing when they were funding the Saudi youth and militants who were training in Pakistan against the Afghani government, what they were doing in Bosnia, what they were doing in Kosovo, what they were doing at the behest of the Central Intelligence Agency and U.S. rulers to destabilize ex-Yugoslavia, to destabilize the Soviet Union's involvement with the Afghani government. This had been going on for many years, and the funding agent, the conduit for this, was the Saudi money and drug laundering money through the role of Khalid bin Mahfouz, which we have discussed time and again on Taking AIM programs in relationship to Khalid bin Mahfouz and his connections with the Bush family, both Bush Sr. and our current president, George Bush.
Well, the disinformation which Gerald Posner is so actively disseminating, and which the New York Times and Time magazine, and I have to say the even on the Pacifica Network, is being orchestrated today in some quarters. This disinformation is longstanding. USA Today on October 28th, 1999, in Jack Kelly's article, Saudi Money Aiding the Terrorist Bin Laden. This is 1999. More than a year after U.S. bombings in East Africa, the prominent businessmen in Saudi Arabia are transferring tens of millions of dollars to bank accounts linked to indicted terrorist Osama bin Laden, senior U.S. intelligence officials told USA Today. According to Saudi government audits acquired by U.S. intelligence, five of Saudi Arabia's top businessmen ordered the National Commercial Bank, the king's largest, to transfer funds diverted from the Saudi pension fund to New York and London banks. And indeed, the article proceeds to set up the Saudis as the culprits. Of course, we have long documented that the event that has just been mentioned by USA Today, naming the blowing up of the U.S. embassy in Nairobi, was, as the San Francisco Chronicle so well documented, the work of a high-level FBI informant. Not only was he involved in organizing and implementing the blowing up of that embassy in a false flag operation, but he was so well placed that he was preparing and organizing bodyguards for bin Laden himself. Khalid, yes, ma'am.
Oh, go on, finish.
Khalid bin Mahfouz, which we have since our broadcast, World Trade Center Uncensored History, laid forth, was not just the Osama bin Laden benefactor and the brother-in-law of Osama bin Laden, but Khalid bin Mahfouz is the principal figure in BCCI and in the Saudi banks that were funding George W. Bush and Harkin Energy and Arbusto, a long-standing relationship between Khalid bin Mahfouz and the CIA go-between James Bass, who, in fact, were involved with Bush father and son in the elaborate financial and intelligence operations of the Saudi monarchy and the Bush oil men and the Central Intelligence Agency itself. Khalid bin Mahfouz and James Bass, well, George Bush was director of the Central Intelligence Agency, were being directed in the operations about which Posner and others are now attempting to father them exclusively upon the Saudis, as if this little corrupt feudal monarchy in Saudi Arabia had decided on its own to pit itself against U.S. imperialism in the world in relation to Osama bin Laden, a figure who the Central Intelligence Agency generated through the very Saudis that are now being fingered for the job of their masters.
Ralph, Khalid bin Mahfouz and his cohorts have been represented by the powerful Washington, D.C. law firm throughout these years in their dealings with the U.S. corporations and with the banking and with the Saudis by Aiken, Gump, Strauss, Hauer, and Feld, LLP, one of the most powerful firms in Washington.
And Bath was working for the billionaire Sheikh Mahfouz, Saudi billionaire financier Abdul Bakhsh, for George W. Bush Jr.'s Arbusto Company, then renamed Bush Exploration, as these funds from BCCI through Khalid bin Mahfouz were channeled first into Harkin Energy, then into Arbusto, later into the Carlyle Group. Bakhsh, Saudi banker Khalid bin Mahfouz, was also a close associate of the Stevens Company of Jackson Stevens, and involved not only in Harkin Energy, but in Bill Clinton's campaigns, the ruling class intimately linked to the Saudi money laundering, drug smuggling, bank corrupted, sustaining of these terror units that were deployed, and I speak here of Al-Qaeda, as indeed of the Taliban, the terror units that were deployed to destabilize the Central Asian states of the Soviet Union. What we are looking at here is the attempt to cut it off at the pass. It's called a limited hangout, in intelligence terms. The limited hangout, as the evidence is diffused by people who have been documenting and exposing the relationship of the ruling class to the terror operations, of which 9/11 is but a little continuation. 9/11 itself showing the hands of intelligence all over it. The Saudis are going to carry the can for this, because it sustains not only the objective of cutting off at the pass the exposure of the role of American intelligence and American rulers in the terror apparatus, which is in fact the instrument of the terror state, that tiny cabal that runs the capitalist state, but is indeed the vehicle for destabilizing each country whose resources they seek and whose military occupation they have long prepared.
Ralph, Time magazine reporters Jonathan Beatty and S.W. Gwynn wrote a book, The Outlaw Bank, A Wild Ride into the Secret Heart of BCCI. And in it they did a lot of investigation. And they found out that the purchase of the Texas Commerce Bank Tower was purchased by Khalid bin Mahfouz. And the owners of the Texas Commerce Bank had been the Baker family. James Baker, very close, the Secretary of State for George Bush Sr. And Baker and Botts, the law firm for the Baker family, were the principal holders of the Texas Commerce stock. What's interesting about this purchase is that it was done when there was the real estate crash in the Houston market. And the tower had been built for $140 million at the apex of the oil boom. And here we were at the time of the oil crash. Yet Khalid bin Mahfouz paid the elder Bush's family friends $200 million, $60 million more at the bottom of the real estate market, $60 million more than the building had been constructed for at the apex of the oil boom. This shows you the close connections between Khalid bin Mahfouz and the Bush-Baker cabal.
Now, Maya, the book Why America Slept by Gerald Posner, on which Time Magazine and New York Times and the bourgeois media are now attempting to hang their Saudi hat, this particular book states that Prince Turki Al-Faisal bin Abdulaziz, the longtime Saudi intelligence chief, was in fact the figure to whom Al-Zubaydah was reporting. Well, then Turki Al-Faisal bin Abdulaziz met with Osama bin Laden for a series of times in relation to the preparation of the terror apparatus in Afghanistan. There was a subsequent meeting in Dubai. In July of 2001, a meeting, however, with the Central Intelligence Agency, Osama bin Laden, and Prince Turki Al-Faisal bin Abdulaziz, the Saudi intelligence chief. And that, of course, Posner is careful to omit. Robert Loomis, his editor, his sponsor, the husband of his former wife, Gloria Loomis, had secretary to James Angleton. It is also Robert Loomis who was the editor for the autobiography of Richard Helms, director of the Central Intelligence Agency. When it comes to media assets, when it comes to the control over publishing, when it comes to the official Central Intelligence Agency books, when it comes to the disinformation, which is then orchestrated ad nauseam, we know where the real disinformation derives, from where it emanates, and whose interests are being served.
Ralph, to go back to the funding in Afghanistan, the funding in Bosnia, the funding in Kosovo of the Saudi-sponsored, at the behest of the CIA groups to dislocate those governments. The Financial Times, September 9, 2002, in an article by Glenn Simpson and Steve Levine, ostensibly to talk about, quote, Saudis disavow joint action with U.S. on assets, that is, the freezing of Saudi assets supposedly tied to September 11th events. In this article, there is very revealing information. They talk about the freezing of the assets of Wael Julaidan, who worked closely with Osama bin Laden in the 1980s to, quote, dislodge Soviet forces from Afghanistan, and today is a top Saudi charity official. It's interesting to look at the history of Mr. Julaidan. He studied in Arizona. He was a leader of the Tucson Islamic Center. And during the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan, he was the main private distributor of the funds from Saudi Arabia and other Arab sources to the anti-Soviet fighters. And he was the third figure in a triumvirate, including Mr. bin Laden and Abdullah Azzam. Abdullah Azzam was a Jordanian-Palestinian who died during a car bomb attack in Peshawar in 1989. Now, during these years, Mr. Julaidan, Osama bin Laden, and Abdullah Azzam were heroes to the Central Intelligence Agency and U.S. rulers. They were heroes. They were the anti-Soviet fighters. Under the pseudonym Abu Hassan al-Madani, Mr. Julaidan headed the Peshawar, Pakistan office of the Saudi Red Crescent. Now, this, according to the Financial Times, was, quote, at the height of the anti-Soviet resistance effort. Note they call it resistance effort in the mid and late 1980s. And he provided, through the Red Crescent, they say, quote, the richest source of financial support for the anti-Soviet fighters. In other words, at this moment in history, these were the heroes to the imperial powers. The network, according to the Financial Times and substantiated elsewhere, was created by these three men, Osama bin Laden, Wael Julaidan, and Abdullah Azzam. And this was the network that became Al-Qaeda in the early 1990s. Now, again, they appear with the Rabita Trust. And the Rabita Trust was the financier of Al-Qaeda. And during the Balkans conflict of the mid-1990s, Mr. Julaidan appears again. He was the key figure funneling aid to the Muslims who were dislocating Yugoslavia.
Maya, to see this in its full clarity, GOP USA bringing the conservative message to America.
Ralph, I would like to make one point, though.
Please.
Because in Yugoslavia, it is made to seem as if it was an ethnic conflict, but in fact it wasn't. Because all groups lived together very well in Yugoslavia, and the struggle in Yugoslavia, the dislocation of Yugoslavia, was a struggle against the working class of Yugoslavia, and was precipitated by the imperial powers through the International Monetary Fund.
Yes, we documented this very exhaustively in Death and Devastation in the Balkans and Anatomy of Imperial Rule, in which we demonstrated that it was, in fact, U.S. special forces that were assigned to the task of attacking the Croats on behalf of Milosevic, an actual specific U.S. special force that carried this out for Milosevic, the Serbs on behalf of Tudjman, and both on behalf of Itzik Begovic of the Bosnian and Kosovo Muslims. In fact, you had in former Yugoslavia the Nomenklatura, the former intelligence chiefs of the Communist Party, the Stalinist apparatus in Yugoslavia, who were implementing the IMF plans. It was, in fact, the austerity measures of Milosevic and of Tudjman, of Izetbegovic, and all of the former intelligence operatives of the Stalinist regime who were bending to the IMF that precipitated a 2 million mass strike of the workers who were organized across ethnic lines, on class lines in Yugoslavia, that precipitated the dislocation plan, the ethnic cleansing conflict plan, which was an intelligence function. And the Saudi role in relation to this in Kosovo and in Bosnia was totally under the aegis of the Central Intelligence Agency. The documentation is precise, it is dated, it is cited, it is elaborated.
And here we have the Financial Times stating openly and clearly the key players here, really the agents for the Central Intelligence Agency through the Saudi Fund, because the Saudis aren't doing this on their own. They're doing it at the behest of the Central Intelligence Agency and the U.S. imperial rulers. The destabilization of Afghanistan to seize control of the Central Asian arena. Remember, we talked about last week the importance of Central Asia and breakup of Afghanistan in order to have those pipelines, and also the breakup of the Soviet Union to seize the oil of the Central Asian republics. And key to this also is the Balkan region. So we have here now, in the setting up of Saudis, targeting the very instruments of the funding of U.S. policy throughout the 80s and the 90s.
Well, I started to mention, Maya, in relation to this, the particular role that the Posner book and its orchestration is playing today. And the GOP USA document by Carol Devine Molin on September 8th makes it very clear. Posner, she writes, zeroes in on the unholy alliance that both Pakistani and Saudi Arabia plays today in complete conjunction with al-Qaeda. The government of Saudi Arabia would have us believe they are simply victims paying protection money to al-Qaeda, but the relationship is far deeper. And indeed, it's interesting to note that Chapter 10 of this book is called Rush to Judgment, even as its title, Why America Slept, is plagiarized from John F. Kennedy's own book in relation to World War II, and an earlier book by that title by Winston Churchill. Chapter 10, Rush to Judgment, is the title of Mark Lane's seminal book, which blew open the official cover for the Kennedy execution, which exposed the fraudulence of the Warren Report. I have a particularly close relationship to that book. It was written in my flat in London when we brought Mark over to the Bertrand Russell Peace Foundation at the time, and we set up the Who Killed Kennedy Committee and the Citizens Commission of Inquiry in New York, when we were able to obtain the documents that showed the CIA numbers of Lee Harvey Oswald, the FBI numbers of Lee Harvey Oswald, the FBI role of Jack Ruby, the role of Clay Shaw, the entire apparatus of the Central Intelligence Agency in that execution. Rush to judgment, indeed. What is the rush to judgment of which Posner speaks? The evidence of the Saudi involvement in the Oklahoma City bombing. The multitude of clues that point to Muslim terrorism. The FBI failure to follow those clues. We went from a Middle East investigation to a domestic one on the turn of a dime, he says. And he proceeds in his rush to judgment to describe another important aspect of his setting up of the Saudis. Zubaydah identified, he writes, the following as accomplices of al-Qaeda. Prince Ahmed bin Salman bin Abdulaziz, the owner of the Kentucky Derby winner war emblem, referred to as Prince Ahmed. And now it's interesting about this, because this 41-year-old man who obtained so much attention in the United States when his long-shot horse not only won the Kentucky Derby, but the Preakness, and had a shot at the Triple Crown at the Belmont, only for the Saudi prince to fail to appear, only for his horse suddenly to be injured at the starting gate, unable to complete the race. Seemingly unrelated events, except that Prince Ahmed, Posner cites, was suddenly found dead, and it was attributed to a heart attack. And his cousin, Prince Sultan bin Faisal bin Turki Al Saud, the relative of Prince Fahd bin Turki bin Saud Al Kabir, died in a putative car crash on his way to the funeral. And yes, the high-ranking military officer, Prince Turki, the Saudi intelligence chief, died. And yes, the young 25-year-old Prince Al-Kabir Turki died supposedly of thirst in the following days. And yes, Air Marshal Mushaf Al-Mir, along with his entourage, died when their aircraft, as Posner writes, unexpectedly experienced difficulties and crashed at the same time. And he writes, Saudi officials have yet to offer an explanation for the plane accident that occurred during favorable weather. Prince Ahmed died of a heart attack at age 43. His cousin, Prince Sultan bin Faisal bin Turki Al Saud, age 41, dies in a car accident, in quotes, while supposedly speeding to Prince Ahmed's funeral. Lastly, Prince Fahd bin Turki bin Saud Al Kabir, age 25, ostensibly dies of thirst due to the summer heat while traveling in the province of Ramah on the next day. Died of thirst with all that designer water that the Saudi royals have on hand? Nobody dies of thirst anymore, unless, of course, you're among the elderly of France, shunted at home during an abominable heat wave, Posner writes. Suddenly he's discovering the possibility of conspiratorial involvement in these deaths. On whom does he father these executions? Why, the Saudi royal family. The fact that these are individuals, these princes, that had carried out the operation with al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, that had been involved in the promotion of the terror apparatus in Central Asia on behalf of Central Intelligence, directed by the George Bush operations, in fact, funded by $30 billion from the Central Intelligence Agency, specific to the purpose in hand. These removals have the hands of U.S. intelligence all over them, even as the cover-up and the orchestration of An attempt to father all this on the Saudis alone is the hand of a limited hangout Central Intelligence Operation disinformation campaign itself. The murder of the Saudi princes, four within a week, together with the air marshal and his entourage in Pakistan, coincides with the next issue of Time magazine, the Pakistani involvement in 9/11. You can see where this is going. You can see what it's all about.
You are listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Setting Up the Saudis. This is WBAI 99.5 FM in New York and on the internet, www.wbai.org. If you missed the parts of today's program or you'd like to rehear it or listen to any of our other shows, we have an internet site with a program archive, www.takingaim.info. Again, our program today, Setting Up the Saudis. Ralph, in terms of Saudi funding, we've spoken about Afghanistan, Bosnia, Kosovo. Now, let's look at another Saudi-sponsored funding
operation,
and that is Hamas. Hamas, according to the Israelis, the estimated donations coming from Saudi Arabia are about $5 million a year, and the Israelis have even estimated up to $14 million a year coming from Saudi Arabia. What the Israelis, the Zionist intelligence operations, the Mossad in particular, don't mention is that the Hamas was particularly sponsored and fostered by the Mossad itself.
Specifically by Ariel Sharon.
As an instrument to undermine the Palestine Liberation Organization. And they did this by allowing the Hamas organizations, which originally were social service organizations, to function within Gaza in particular, and then to ban the organizations of the Palestine Liberation Organization. They allowed the Islamic University to foster while undermining through closures and preventing the operations of the secular Palestinian operations. Another thing they did, the Mossad did, was to infiltrate Hamas, and it has been revealed to initiate, to foster the first of the suicide bombings.
Maya, just as Victor Ostrovsky and the Other Side of Deception and Ari Ben-Menashe have established that many of the operations imputed to Hezbollah, imputed to Hamas, were in fact false flag operations of the Mossad. So the timing of this front page article in the New York Times to which you are referring, Flow of Saudis Cash to Hamas, September 17, 2003, Don Van Natta Jr. and Timothy L. O'Brien, what they don't tell you in this New York Times article is that's a replay of an article that was published in the Jerusalem Post but a few days before. And it says, nearly a year ago, Khalid Mishal, the senior leader of Hamas, the militant Palestinian organization, attended a charitable fundraising conference where he talked at length with Crown Prince Abdullah, the de facto Saudi ruler, and it goes on from there to associate Saudi intelligence with Hamas. Indeed, Saudi intelligence was involved with Hamas from a very early time at the direction of the Mossad. Here in the San Francisco Bay Area Independent Media Center, a detailed elaboration of this, quote, Hamas was set up by Sharon. The criminal element of the state realized that in order to mobilize opinion, they would have to establish something to discredit and to undermine the effective claim to represent the Palestinian people of the Palestine Liberation Organization. Israel, quote, embarked on an aggressive approach that involves staged, targeted killings, not only in Israel, not only outside, but in the United States and other friendly countries. Former Israeli intelligence officials told United Press International that Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon has, in fact, organized the undertaking. And it dates back to the terrorist group Hamas, which was founded and funded by Israel's dominant Likud party and the Israeli Mossad. In particular detail, does this report cite the day-by-day organization of Hamas by the Mossad. Israel and Hamas were locked in a nominal combat But former U.S. intelligence officials have documented that since the late 1980s, Tel Aviv gave direct financial aid to Hamas over a period of years. It's a 12-page documentation of the Village of Leagues, who were set up by Israeli intelligence agency, the Shin Bet, provided the weapons training for Hamas. A network of thousands of informers was established. The deliberate insinuation of this competing faction was intended to undermine the Palestine Liberation Organization, and I'm continuing to quote, Prime Minister Ariel Sharon had the key role in the formation of this policy. The first wave of suicide bombings, which began in 1994, were in fact organized by the Mossad and imputed to Hamas, whose Mossad operatives were engaged in the undertaking. Sharon is conducting a vicious operation inside to secure popular support for war by staging continuous terror scares, the article continues. Israeli intelligence officials confirm that almost nightly, Israeli police are engaged in coordination with these operations. Previous to Israel's intervention, Hamas was a dormant, sidelined, minority, marginal group. According to United Press International, the Israeli establishment and the intelligence apparatus saw Hamas as the appropriate vehicle not only for their long war against Palestinian nationalism, but for instigating a campaign against terror that would capture the central places of American policymaking itself. There is a long documented history of the false flag operation of which Hamas's funding and organization by the Mossad and Shin Bet are but a particular example, now being imputed on the front page of the New York Times to the Saudi regime alone, setting up the Saudis.
The transformation of the Middle East. This is the stated policy of Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz, which was articulated clearly in the Sunshine Warrior, a major cover story that appeared in the New York Times last year. Now we have September 15th, 2003. Special report, The Legacy of 9/11, banner headline of the Time magazine, The Saudis, whose side are they on in the war on terror? With a large drawing of a Saudi sheikh with sunglasses staring out from the cover. And inside, there is a Time CNN poll, which I'd like to state at the head, was conducted with only 1,003 adult Americans, September 3rd and 4th, by Harris Interactive. But yet on the basis of this 1,000 telephone interview with the leading questions, CNN and Time conclude, do you think Saudi Arabia is a country the United States can trust as an ally? Cannot trust, 72%. Is Saudi Arabia cooperating with the U.S. as much as it can in the war against terrorism? 71% answered no. Time CNN poll, setting up the Saudis. And in the article by Lisa Beyer with Scott McLeod, reporting from Riyadh in Saudi Arabia. They state, quote, some critics of Saudi Arabia are suggesting that the United States invaded the wrong country and seized the wrong oil wells in the spring.
Maya, for a period of 25 years, since the mid-70s, the agenda of the Mossad, since the publication of a strategy for the 1980s, has called for the fragmentation of each Middle Eastern country, and in particular for the seizure of Saudi oil fields and for the sectoring off of the eastern part of Saudi Arabia under direct military rule, while a series of small ethnic and religious factions are left to scramble for the remainder of former Saudi Arabia. And indeed, that theme has been orchestrated by every United States administration preparing for direct seizure of Arab oil since 1964. I have cited in our book, Iraq and Kuwait, A History Suppressed, the particular organization of these efforts, Robert Tucker's Oil, the Issue of American Intervention, in commentary in January 1975. Without intervention, there is the possibility distinct of an economic and political disaster comparable to the disaster of the 1930s. Harper's Magazine with Miles Ignotis. Miles Ignotis is a pseudonym for Edward Luttwak, a leading Pentagon consultant and Defense Intelligence Agency operative. Seizing Arab Oil, the Rapid Deployment and Strike Scenario. And indeed, it was called by Tucker the New El Dorado Awaiting Its Conquistadors. Jimmy Carter had devised, as early as 1977, a secret presidential directive, PD-18, calling for rapid intervention in the Middle East and for the seizure of the oil fields of Saudi Arabia. Indeed, it was a task that was assigned by Henry Jackson and by the neocons and the Democrats of the day to the Shah of Iran, who was instructed to undertake a conflict with the Saudis and to take over on behalf of the U.S. the Saudi oil fields. This is a long orchestrated and prepared operation in which the pass-through comprador rulers of the Saudis were considered to be usable and disposable.
Ralph, the relationship with Saudi Arabia was fostered by Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and it was U.S. oil companies that built the infrastructure and controlled the oil exploration and the pumping of oil throughout Saudi Arabia, giving a concession, giving payment to the Saudi rulers, and controlled what became Aramco. This was controlled by Standard Oil of California, now known as California Standard, Texas Oil Company, which was Texaco, Standard Oil of New Jersey, which later became Exxon, and Saucony Vacuum, later known as Mobil. And through the consolidation of the oil industry, Exxon and Mobil are now one company. And Aramco later gave through demands, the Saudi Arabian government a 25% stake. That was 1973. And the stake, the share of the Saudis increased to 60% in 1974. But with the Iranian Revolution, of which you can speak more, the Saudis in 1980, with what was called a, according to the Saudis, an amicable agreement, Aramco became 100% Saudi-owned, with the date of ownership backdating to 1976.
There's a very specific dynamic to that decision to allow the Saudis to capture 100% of the revenues. Of course, we understand that those revenues were immediately to be deposited in the United States Treasury in the form of Treasury bonds and Treasury notes, sustaining the U.S. economy. Much of the profits were kicked back not only to oil companies, but to the directors of the of those oil companies and to the princes in numbered offshore accounts. But this arrangement followed upon the Iranian Revolution, because the Iranian Revolution triggered a radicalization of the Shia-populated Gulf Emirates, and in particular, what has been not well reported, a mass uprising in Saudi Arabia itself of the Shia population, put down with enormous and barbarous force by special forces of the United States, aiding and directing the Saudi suppression and mass murder of the Shia population in rebellion against their rule. And all the time that this concession was made, Brzezinski met in Kuwait in the aftermath of the revolution in Iran with King Fahd of Saudi Arabia, with Asaba the Emir of Kuwait, with Saddam Hussein, and the four of them prepared an Iraqi attack upon upon Iran to amputate the oil-producing province of Iran, Khuzestan. The funding of that Iraqi war against Iran was from Saudi Arabia and the Gulf Emirates, the arming from the United States, the weapons of mass destruction from the United States, and the Iranians were supplied by the Israelis. Henry Kissinger expressed it rather well. if we don't succeed in obtaining the oil province of Iran, we will bleed them white. Over a million casualties as the consequence. And then the Emir of Kuwait moves his arbitrary country amputated from Iraq by the British at the turn of the century, 900 square kilometers north, where he now is abutting the Ramallah oil fields, and he buys the Santa Fe Drilling Company in Alhambra, California, for $2.3 billion for its slant drilling equipment, and proceeds with this horizontal drilling equipment to suck out $14 billion of Iraqi oil, by the way. Brent Scowcroft, the national security advisor to George Bush Sr., and Robert Mosbacher, his secretary of commerce, were on the board of directors of the Santa Fe Drilling Corporation in Alhambra, California. That is the nature of the operation. The Saudis had their assignment to fund the Iraqi invasion of Iran. Saddam Hussein, their point man in this whole task. With the Iranian Revolution, they sought to not only undermine the Iranian Revolution, but now to make concessions to the Saudi monarchy to serve this task. And simultaneous with this was the creation of the terror apparatus of Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan for destabilizing the Soviet Union in the process. This entire strategy for the region has to do with seizing oil and using these comprador elements, these country-selling regimes, for the purpose until they in turn are to be discarded, abused, and discarded and demonized as their predecessors have always been.
Ralph, aside from the Saudi money which passes through to propping up the U.S. economy through investments and the purchase of U.S. treasuries, it's important to look at the fact that 40% of the Saudi revenue, and most of this revenue comes from the oil production, 40% is used for the purchase of arms. Arms from Great Britain, arms from the United States. Now, it's not as if Saudi Arabia uses these arms, the jet planes, the AWACS, the huge defense arsenal, mostly for large aircraft. The purpose of this is a subsidy to Lockheed, to Northrop Grumman. Northrop Grumman, by the way, owns Vinnell, and Vinnell trains the Saudi militia, those that protect the royal family, the special agents. And also in Great Britain, according to Safra World, the value of licenses for arms sales to Saudi Arabia was up £9 million last year, at the same time that Great Britain is joining in with the United States with setting up the Saudis, and in its human rights report prepared a longer section than last year, voicing, quote, credible specific reports of the use of torture to gain confessions. Ralph?
Maya, it's appropriate that we look at the constant and orchestrated theme of taking out the Saudis. All through the period when the Saudis were being used for this purpose, their subsequent demise was already being mapped. Now, I mentioned before the article of Associated Press that was published in USA Today. The 9/11 plot began in 1996 with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the so-called mastermind, under the direction of the Saudi royals, according to that AP report. William Crystal in the Weekly Standard, the intellectual theoretical magazine of the neocons and the architects of the policy of permanent war, The Coming Saudi Showdown, on July 9, 2002, in which this elaborated article calls for the removal of the regime for the necessary direct seizure of Saudi oil. And on August 6th of 2002, the Washington Post described a briefing depicting the Saudis as enemies with an ultimatum urged to the Pentagon board.
Ralph, as recently as this Sunday, Scotland on Sunday headlined, "Experts Warn of Saudi Arabia Nuclear Threat." Ian Mather, their diplomatic correspondent. And this followed a BBC monitoring of Pakistani reports that said that Saudi Arabia had, quote, the right to have nuclear weapons. According to a report last week, the Saudi government is considering three options, one of which is to acquire a nuclear deterrent. The other choices are to maintain or enter into an alliance with an existing nuclear power that would offer protection, or to have a regional agreement on a nuclear-free Middle East, which Scotland on Sunday discounts. They put forward the idea that the Saudis are looking for acquiring nuclear weapons. Judith Yaffe, the senior research fellow for Middle East at the Institute for National Strategic Studies at the National Defense University in Washington, states, "We are the sole superpower, meaning the United States. And if we see something threatening to us, we have the right to act preemptively. It raises the all-important question, who's next? If you carry this remaking of the Middle East to its conclusion, with Iraq as the model to emulate, it's not going to be just Syria or Iran. It's going to be Saudi Arabia. It's going to be the Gulf states. It's going to be Egypt. It's going to be everyone."
Maya,
people,
yes,
in
please.
The region are worried.
That exactly corresponds to the declarations by John Bolton, the U.S. Undersecretary of State, to the Senate committee when he said, "Our concern is the nuclear and missile programs of Iran and Syria and Pakistan and Saudi Arabia." Iran and Syria and Pakistan and Saudi Arabia. All of this a calculated, timed series of orchestrations which led the British Member of Parliament, George Galloway, as reported in the Tehran Times on October 14th in 2002, a speech that George Galloway made at the American University of Beirut, in which he disclosed an intelligence plan, quote, "American and British leaders are in the process of carrying out longstanding plans to break up Saudi Arabia and Sudan and expand Jordan's borders to areas in central Iraq." Galloway stated in his speech published by the Lebanese daily Al-Bayan that the document was a long-prepared document of British and American intelligence, which targeted Saudi Arabia in particular and prepared for the seizure of its oil.
And British imperialism turned around and has attacked George Galloway, the British Labour MP, long-standing MP, who was vehement in his opposition to the U.S. invasion, along with the British invasion of Iraq.
You move forward to the National Post in Canada on April 10, 2003, who is next on America's list. The regimes that meet the criteria of intervention, which has been prepared now for some time, are not armed with weapons of mass destruction, but they are in possession of great centers of oil. Mr. Powell's assurances notwithstanding, these entities are being treated as belligerent states. We shall expose them to the consequences of their belligerency with invasion. This is particularly true for the Saudi royals. They'd be safer on their oily thrones if, instead of funding and condoning Islamofascist terror, they stuck to their benign expressions of their culture as stoning adulterers, amputating the hands of thieves, and preventing women from driving the National Post on the plans of imperialism. And the Defense Policy Board, June 6, 2002. This is the Washington Post, Thomas Ricks. Briefing depicts the Saudis as the real enemies. A briefing last month through the top Pentagon Advisory Board described Saudi Arabia as a target enemy of the United States and recommended the United States officials provide an ultimatum to stop backing terror or face direct seizure of its oil fields and all its financial assets. The Washington Post: the Saudis, quote, "are active at every level of the terror chain, from planners to financiers, from cadre to foot soldier, from ideologist to cheerleader." It was presented, this document, in an explosive briefing on July 10th to the Defense Policy Board, the group of prominent intellectuals and former senior officials that advises the Pentagon on defense policy. The Saudis plan to end the U.S. presence, warns the New York Times on February 9th, 2003. Saudi Arabia's leaders have made far-reaching decisions to prepare for the complete military disengagement from the United States. Senior members of the royal family say the decisions reached in the last month are the result of a continuing debate over Saudi Arabia's future, which they have not yet publicly announced.
Yes, Ralph, they were saying that, and yet during the invasion, the assault against Iraq, Saudi Arabia, with the Prince Sultan Air Force Base, still provided the intelligence operations for the attack. Because, as the Financial Times noted, war is seen as the first step towards a new U.S.-imposed order for the region. And this is recognized in Saudi Arabia. They quote a university professor. There could be a breakup of Iraq, a puppet regime installed, and this could lead to the breakup of other countries. Even the Saudis could be affected. So it is well known throughout Saudi Arabia, despite allowing 500,000 U.S. troops to be based in Saudi Arabia for the first Gulf War, despite the funding of the first Gulf War, predominantly by Saudi Arabia, despite the funding of the assault against Afghanistan, with the funding of the so-called resistance to the Soviet Union's presence in Afghanistan, despite the funding of the so-called resistance, Muslim resistance in ex-Yugoslavia, in Bosnia, in Kosovo, despite the funding of Hamas in the assault against the Palestine Liberation Organization, despite the relationship with all the oil companies and with all the imperial powers and the corporations such as Bechtel, which has built most of Saudi Arabia, despite all this, they are setting up Saudi Arabia for direct seizure of the resources of the region.
And here is Daniel Pipes, the scandal of U.S.-Saudi relations, in which he calls for direct intervention in an elaborated article, and he cites the Saudis as the target. We are at a crossroads. And he cites Crown Prince Abdullah, who says the United States and Saudi Arabia have met the moment of separate interests. Those governments that don't feel the pulse of their people and respond to it will suffer the fate. And what is the conclusion of Pipes? Seize the country, dispose of the regime, grab its oil.
Grab its oil. It is not a question of democracy. It is a question of seizure of resources. Setting up the Saudis. This has been Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. You can reach us at 212-209-2953, or you can call us in California at 707-552-9995. Our email is takingaim@pacbell.net, and our website is www.takingaim.info. We'll be with you next week.
Ta-tam-ta, chinda-ta-ro, ta-tam-ta. Ilon-dok-mi-wala-ga.